You know the quiet guy in your office? You know who I'm talking about. The guy who's unassuming, maybe a little geeky, a bit shy. Well, at NPR, his name's Robert Goldstein. He's one of our librarians. And a while back, I found something out about Rob that floored me. You see, back in the late 70s, Rob was almost a rock star, a guitarist in the DC band The Urban Verbs. Listen to Rob's guitar here. A few years ago, Rob Goldstein was flipping through a rock encyclopedia, and he came across the entry on The Urban Verbs.
First sentence was, fascinating but tragically overlooked.
And that's the story of The Urban Verbs. They'll reunite for one show this evening at a club here in Washington. In 1978, the stars aligned almost too perfectly for The Urban Verbs. The lead singer, Roddy Franz, had a direct connection to the Talking Heads. Roddy's brother, Chris, was the drummer. At the time, the Talking Heads were working with legendary rock producer Brian Eno, as Roddy explains.
They had finished up a session with Brian, and Chris said, "Hey, Brian, do you feel like going into CBGB's, my little brother's band's playing?" And Brian apparently was just blown away by the mesh of sound that we were creating.
Brian Eno offered to produce a few tracks, including this one, for the virtually unknown band. Within a few weeks, guitarist Robert Goldstein started sending those tracks to record labels.
It was very easy to get them to listen to a demo tape that had Brian Eno's name on it.
Now, at that time, the only way to get your music heard, even to be taken seriously by clubs, was to get a record deal. You couldn't just post your stuff to MySpace like plenty of ambitious bands do today. The Verbs were the real deal. They had Eno behind them, and soon producer Steve Lillywhite agreed to work with them as well. Lillywhite had already produced records for acts like Peter Gabriel and U2. But there were forces that even the best producers and musicians in the business couldn't surmount. I asked Robert Goldstein and Roddy Franz about those forces when we sat down together earlier this week. You guys had arguably some really amazing advantages. I mean, you had Brian Eno willing to work with you. Your manager worked with Blondie. What happened? Why didn't it happen,
you mean?
Why didn't it happen?
Yeah. Well, it's a question that obviously we spent a lot of time wondering about. We were told by this fellow at Warner Brothers, you guys have taken the artistic route, and that implies certain things about what you've got to do. You're not going to be able to get hit records maybe right off the bat. And because we couldn't get on the radio, that just meant we had to spend that much more time performing in front of people to build an audience who would demand the records, and then that would transfer to radio. Because we didn't do that, however you want to formulate that sort of strategy, I think that's one business reason why enough people didn't get to hear what we were doing and then decide, I want to buy those records.
The other thing that just killed us was my relationship with the drummer and the Talking Heads. Because we were mining some similar territory.
You were often compared to David Byrne.
I think that was a somewhat fair comparison in some cases, but...
People were saying you guys are the Talking Heads light.
Right? Yeah, and you know, I still hear that. I mean, it makes me crazy. But we also got ambushed by a particularly virulent review in Rolling Stone and just slaughtered us.
Many of the people at Warner Brothers in Los Angeles, they were just starting to get to know us and figure out what we were, where to put us, and then to see this total slam in Rolling Stone about something they didn't yet even understand, I think it kind of demoralized them a little bit, too.
How often do you guys think about the Urban Verbs, Roddy?
You know, I deliberately turned my back on it. When the band disbanded, I said, okay, it's never going to be this good again. I'm going to do other things, and I did.
Robert Goldstein, how often do you think about the Urban Verbs and about what could have been?
I guess it's probably more accurate to say, when don't I? You know, to be honest, because... In the same way that Rod just said, I mean, for me, in my desire to be an interesting guitar player, this was my apogee. And I felt that, I remember something that The Edge from U2 said a long time ago in talking about how they were going to finally get back in the studio, said, the world needs to hear my guitar. And I thought that was great of him to say that, and I just felt like I had something to say on guitar, and it was sort of stilled somehow. And I felt just at the point I was becoming the guitar player I wanted to be, the thing was all over.
That's Robert Goldstein, NPR music librarian, and earlier we heard from Roddy Franz, the founding members of the Urban Verbs, a band that just skimmed the outer edge of stardom. Here's their biggest single. It's called Subways.
Subways, we're all going the same direction. Subways, we're all going the same speed. Subways, it all gets obscured. Then it begins to make sense.
Now, if you happen to be in Washington, you can catch the Urban Verbs at the 9:30 Club tonight. And if not, you can hear a replay online tomorrow at npr.org/music.
Even though I've never met them, I can assure you they're my best friends on this subway. Cause we share an emotion. Subway, you know it's vaguely enticing. Subway, I'm under confusion. Now I can relax. Down here I don't have to say anything. I just...
Beware, U.S. Census takers. Danielia Cotton doesn't neatly fit into any box. She's an African-American from a nearly all-white town in New Jersey. She's a singer and songwriter who can sound like a blues balladeer on one track and a hard rock wailer on the next. She's influenced by gospel music, but she's also a convert to Judaism. Danielia Cotton has mined parts of her childhood and her much more recent adulthood for a new CD. It's called Rare Child, and she joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with hearing a little bit of the opening track on this CD, which is Make You Move.
I do a cover of AC/DC's Back in Black, and we were trying to write a song that was, you know, just kind of had a little bit of power.
Let's diagnose that. yeah.
Just like a good guitar riff, good hook, sort of rockin' tune.
Did you grow up listening to a lot of rockers with the volume cranked up to 11?
I was initially attracted to rock and roll because I was a little black kid in a white town, and I was angry, and that music sort of was a place I could put all that aggression. And
now what town are we talking about?
Hopewell, New Jersey.
Do you mind me asking, why were you so angry?
Because I didn't look like everybody else, and I didn't, you don't always fit in, and I think that kids are mean when you're young. I mean, if I could go back and take back a few things that I said to some people when I was in grade school, I think that sometimes that sticks with you. I still, as an adult, remember specific events. Yeah.
But it's interesting to me and very revealing of your character that you say you wish you could go back and take some things back. Because a lot of people spend most of their lives saying, I wish I could go back and show that guy.
It's more that I understand the impact that some of those things had on me. Yeah. And so, you know, if I had done that to someone else, I would like to write that wrong.
What was it about music, do you think, that unlocked something in you? Firstly, when did you notice you had a hell of a voice?
My family is all musical. My mom's a jazz singer. My aunts were background singers. One of them was on the road with Southside Johnny when I was young. And they had a group, a cappella group, called Brooks Ensemble Plus, which is comprised of my mom and her six sisters. And I joined by the time I was 12, and you just sort of realize, like, wow, I could do that too.
I've got to ask you about your choir.
Oh, Kolahad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kolahad, which means one voice, is a multiracial Jewish children's choir. And I think it's because I just, when I initially converted, if you're into Judaism, community service is a very big thing. And I thought that, you know, having been given the gift of song and voice and what have you, playing an instrument and being able to make a career of it, that I would give that back in some way. And I think if I have children, they will obviously be, as I am, Black and Puerto Rican and white, and my husband's a Russian European Jew, our kids won't look like the stereotypical Jew. I knew there were a lot of little kids out there that needed to know that not every Jewish child looks like Jason Schwartz.
Jason Schwartz, you mean?
Yeah, you know, the kids, we definitely, I mean, I think we all cried at our last show. Yeah. It was great. I mean, we all got something out of it. Music's great.
Did you go back and forth between jazz and gospel and hard rock?
No, my taste has always been eclectic. I didn't come back to rock until later in my life. I think I was more sort of, when I first came to New York, a little more singer-songwriter, a little bit more soul in the music. And I think when I was brave enough, I went back to where I really wanted to be, which was more a place that I felt at home, where I could live. When you're singing rock, it's powerful, and through that emoting to the audience, you get a lot out too. You're able to let go of it.
Title track. Now, was that at least partially your story, may I ask?
A little bit. I've never met my father. You know, I would hope that he would regret not being in my life. And my mom was a, you know, single mother raising four kids, so we definitely struggled to survive at times.
Do you know if your father is still around, or do you know who he is even?
I've made an attempt twice, but I've failed in my efforts, so I really don't even know if he's alive.
Forgive a pop psychology question.
It's okay.
Are any of your songs an attempt to make him pay attention?
No. I don't think so. It could be some subconscious, I don't know. No, I really don't. It's not something I'm going for.
You wrote or co-wrote the music and lyrics for just about every track on this CD. Is that important to you?
Yes, it is, actually. When I sing something, even if I'm to do a cover, it has to be a story that I relate to. For me to be able to sing the way I'd like to and give something back to the audience, then I really have to sort of feel that I can live in it. And I never really write about things that I haven't really dealt with in a healthy way myself. It's almost, I studied acting for so long, as Uta Hagen would say, be careful the moments you go back to. If it's a moment that you really haven't reconciled with yourself, it could be not a healthy place to go. So if I write about anything, it's because I really sort of dealt with it myself. And I put it out there because I know I'm not the only one to have the experiences that I've had.
I want to play another clip from this album. I think of a song that might be familiar in the life of any road musician. Let It Ride.
16 days and I'll be home again, to my own bed, to my old friends, the things I'm used to. But there's a charm to all these nameless towns, the brand new streets I'm in and out, the opposite of settled down. But this is what I am. It's just something you have to understand.
Boy, that summarizes it so beautifully.
It's the road.
Yeah.
You know, I actually co-wrote that with my husband, who's sort of the person that has to deal with me going. So it was great that we did it together.
Miss Cotton, so nice talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Danielia Cotton, the singer, songwriter, and guitarist. Her new CD, her second, is now out, and it's called Rare Child. I cannot. And to hear a full concert from Miss Cotton, go to npr.org/music. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.